I don't think there's good or bad food. Let's just say that. And I think that that's the problem now too. I think we're labeling things as good or bad. And I think that there's so many other things impacting the way that we're dealing with food.
Welcome to The Business of Doing Business. I'm your host, Dwayne Kerrigan. With 35 years in business and close to 30 ventures across 12 industries, I've seen a lot. Amid the celebrity allure of entrepreneurship, many exceptional entrepreneurs remain shadowed. Here, I team up with these hidden talents to unveil their challenges and successes. Dive in with me to unearth entrepreneurial gems, learn from our experiences, and get educated. Angie Greenshields, welcome to the show. I'm very blessed to have you here. Thank you so much for spending the time with us all the way from Australia. This is going to be an interesting introduction. You're a certified clinical nutritionist, but your professional journey spans like 20 years of work with a diverse global clientele, guiding them with your expertise in nutrigenomics and functional testing. And every time I tell people about you and I use the word nutrigenomics, they're like, what kind of economics? Like, it's, they don't quite get it. In regards to your education, I'm going to leave that to you because as I was kind of reading through your education, I didn't understand it either. So I'm going to quickly flip that to you and then I'm going to tell everybody how we know each other.
I have a degree from the University of Newcastle. That's where I started in my journey. After I finished, I started working with people and realized that the food wasn't the only story. And you could give two people the same eating plan or the same diet and they're going to react differently. And so I needed to understand a little bit more about the individual and what's going on for them. So I spent a lot of time postgraduate-wise learning about nutrigenomics, so how our genes express themselves when we have different food and different lifestyle, how that looks, so how we're set up to function and how that actually expresses itself based on our lifestyle and our diet. And I also did some postgraduate work in functional testing, so learning how to read them and interpret them and then apply that with the genetic work and the food together.
Right. Full disclosure, I am one of your clients. And so for everybody listening, our family actually met Angie in Mexico while we were down in Mexico having some stem cell treatment done. Long story short, we took my dad, who was, I would say, pretty close to death's door, down for some stem cell treatments after he had had open heart surgery and gotten what I would personally refer to as not the most attention to his recovery plan by his cardiologist. Health was dropping like a stone and we made the decision to go to Mexico and you were there supporting a friend of ours and we had all kind of done this together and that's where we met. And then as soon as I met you and we talked to you, and we went through what you do and what you know, and you sat there and basically supported my dad for, you were there for a week of the three that he was there, correct?
Yeah, about 10 days.
And it was like mind blowing. As soon as I saw you working with him and the things that we discussed, I was like, okay, we're hiring this woman. Yeah, I'm a client. And so full disclosure, I have nothing to gain from this. The reason why, Angie, I wanted to bring you on the show was because of the progress that not only I made, the progress that my wife has made, and the progress that my father had made. I mean, you changed my dad's life. You took him from knocking on death's door to, I mean, his health trajectory went off the charts. He actually ended up passing away in January of a bacterial pneumonia infection, which was completely independent of all his other issues that he had, which was, you know, shocking that he passed because the week before he passed away, he was in Florida golfing, working out at the gym. He's 81 years old, never worked out a day in his life. We had him in the gym. He was super healthy, tons of energy, sleeping. Like he went from not sleeping roughly 2 hours a night, maybe 3 hours a night, to sleeping full 8 hour day durations. Literally, you changed his life. And you've changed my life in regards to, you know, being personally, I can speak, like I have struggled with cholesterol. And I mean, you can probably describe it better than I have, but for 15 years, I've always had this issue of like having to be on statins and all that kind of stuff. And while I'm on a very, 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 very like one quarter of the dose, not even a quarter of the dose that I used to be on and my statins, all my cholesterol is in perfect condition. It's not been like that for 15 years. It was a combination of the bespoke dietary guidance that we were getting from you, the supplementation, the tailored advice on our lifestyle and environmental changes on a consistent basis. But I used to live with constant inflammation in my body. I was constantly in pain, like every single day of my life. It was as though I thought I had like severe arthritis. I don't have any of that. I have some pain, but that's self-induced from being a moron in the gym and throwing around the heavy weight that I probably maybe shouldn't be. I don't know. I love it, but that's why we had you on the show. And I think this is a bit of a dissertation. Sorry to the listeners. Obviously, we're a business podcast, but we're not just a business podcast. We're also a bit of a lifestyle or personal development podcast. But I think the one disadvantage that drivers have is they tend to prioritize work and the accomplishment factor higher. And, you know, at least for me, I tell myself a story like, okay, well, once I get through this, then I'll work on my health, or once I get through this, I'll work on my relationship, or once I get through this. And I think, and I'm very passionate about health and nutrition. I've worked out all my life. I've tried to be healthy. I think that this is a significant area. And I would say also, probably from a projection standpoint, I'm projecting here, but I'm 53 years old. You know, I'm looking at what's ahead, and I want to personally make sure that I, you know, have the right things happening for me. The other reason that I wanted to bring you on is you and I chat back and forth. And sorry, well, you have to sit here and listen to me talk, but I'll send you like Instagram posts and stuff like that. Biohacking has become such a huge hot topic on social media, and longevity and reducing aging and this going on and that going on. And we will talk about these things today, but there is a confusion around what is real good information and what is potentially a little bit disinformation or misunderstanding of the facts, or not representing all of the facts, or not taking in individual, as you said earlier, the individual genetic factors. What works for me for a diet might not work for another person. So there's all these kinds of things, and everybody just kind of white labels them. So I was kind of hoping we could have a conversation about the upsides, downsides of certain things, also the things to consider and the questions that people should ask themselves. But I do think this is important. I think there's a lot of stuff going on. I'll let you kind of lead it out, where you're at, what you're doing, and we'll just kick it into gear.
I remember actually the first day we sat in Cabo and went through your dad's bloods. I remember you looking at me and saying, she's either a fraud or a genius. And it's like, yet to be determined.
Did I actually say that to you?
Yeah.
Okay, it sounds like something I would say.
I like that because it's pretty straight up. And I think that's the thing. I think, especially with your dad, when people go in for major issues into the health system, they look at certain things. They look at disease states. They look at the things that they can control with medicine, and it has its place, absolutely. But I think even like for your dad, he had some mineral imbalances that were really affecting his ability to sleep, and he was cramping. And these are things that can be balanced with nutrients and with electrolytes, and it's stuff that they don't have the time for and maybe don't have the knowledge for as far as balancing those kind of things. So people feel well. I mean, they're great at major disease states, and they're great at operations, and they're great, you know, that's where you'd want to be if you had an accident. But sometimes just getting people to a really healthy spot is not necessarily what they do best. And so for your dad, it was like not messing with any of his medications or anything like that, but it was trying to get him to feel the best that he could and start to feel better after his stem cells and stuff as well. Yeah, it's more nuanced. And I think that's the problem at the moment, especially when we're talking about biohacking and social media, is we're getting small clips of things that are not necessarily wrong. There's some half-truths, and that's what I always say, is half-truths. And half-truths for a lot of people. You can't look at one thing and then apply it to everybody. And I think that's what some of these clips are. It's like, well, everybody should be fasting, or everybody should be cold plunging, or everybody should be, you know, on a low-carb diet. And I think that we're trying to go for the 1% when we haven't got the 99% under wraps yet. So it's a little bit like training. It's like going to the gym and expecting, you know, wanting all these new exercises, but not having the groundwork in place first to build, you know, to build muscle. And thinking that if you just take the right pre-workout, or you just have the right protein after your training. And the truth is that there's 99% of stuff that needs to be done before that makes a difference. And I think that's the same in the health sphere. So are we sleeping? Are we grounding? Are we eating well? Do we have good stress management? All those things first before we start talking about fasting or cold plunging, or do we have the basics in place? And I think that that gets missed a lot. I think it's just, here's a small snippet of something that might be true for a subset of the population, and we're going to tell everybody to do it. I think a lot of people they're struggling at the moment. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to eat. They don't know. Most people are chronically stressed at the moment, and we're asking them to do things that stress their system even more. And I think that that's where we're getting lost a little bit, in these clickbaity kind of things. And you're not the only one of my clients who sends me Instagram reels. It happens a lot. And I love it, actually. I had one of my clients yesterday say, doesn't that bother you? And I'm like, no, I actually like it, because we can start to go through some of the things and we can start to work out the nuances. And is that true for you based on how you set up and where you are in your life? Would that be useful for you? Or is it just kind of clickbait? We're getting a bit lost there at the moment because there's just so much stuff. And a lot of it's, pretty crap.
So the question I was going to ask you about Dad was, and to make it more generic, was what really impressed me when we first met was your understanding of blood. Like, I was blown away. For the audience, backstory, my dad had had an open heart surgery for pericarditis, and he was getting treated with an enormous amount of diuretics. They're monitoring his blood as an indicator to kind of what was happening in his system. And when we met you in Mexico, you went through his blood work. We had like the last three, like he was getting blood done every week type thing. So we had a lot of blood work. And so you went through the results and instantly, and that was, I think, my comment when you, now that I'm thinking about it, and I said, like, she's either a fraudster or she's a genius, because the way you were reading the blood was completely different than the doctors at the hospital. And these are doctors. So you are sitting there as a regular Joe or slash patient slash family member, thinking and trusting that the doctors know exactly what they're doing when it comes to blood, because they're doctors. And that was not the case. And I'm not going to mention their names, and I'm not going to mention the facility that they were at, but it just was not the case. You made some humongous distinctions, which led us to an immediate course of action that did have like an effect on my dad within days. What is the common mistakes made for blood and people's interpretation of blood? Because you could probably describe what was going on better than obviously I could.
And your dad was a bit of a different case because he'd had surgery and he'd had such a big thing. But in his blood specifically, his magnesium was very elevated in the blood. So it was when magnesium should mainly be inside the cell. And so when they test the blood, they're testing the outside of the cell, so what's in the outside space. And so the magnesium was really high, and so was his B12. It was very high in the blood. And so for me, it was, why is it outside the cell? And so if we can push that into the cell, then it can do its job. And because he'd had so many diuretics, he had no electrolytes, like, really in his body. It was, and they were all in the wrong spot. So his magnesium and potassium should be inside the cell, and they were starting to become elevated outside the cell. And the same as B12. So his B12 was elevated because it wasn't getting in. And so we did some simple things to help balance those out, so that a little bit of low-dose lithium, so that the B12 can be carried inside the cell, because that's one of the nutrients required for the transport of B12. And magnesium, it looked high in the blood, but it was actually deficient in the cell. And so it's just, when you look at it just as being elevated, and people will think it needs to come down, but it's, why is the magnesium elevated outside the cell? Why is the B12 elevated outside the cell? And so when you don't have those things in place, in the right places, you will get cramping. And he was so depleted of electrolytes because of the massive doses of diuretics. And I think just before he came to Mexico, they'd given him a super dose, from what I remember. And when he got there, he was frail and depleted and couldn't stop cramping, because he also couldn't keep sodium, the sodium potassium ratio correct, because he had such a big dose. And so that's that. For your dad, it was more that electrolyte balance from the huge diuretics. But on the whole, I'd say iron is a really big one that gets misinterpreted in the medical profession. I think as soon as they see low ferritin or low iron, they just want to give more iron. And I think we don't look at the whole person, and we don't look at the why. So if you're not bleeding from the bowel, if you don't have celiac disease, if you're not a strict vegan, why is there not enough iron in the blood? Is it a recycling issue? Is it a, you know, is it an absorption issue? Like, what else is going on instead of just giving more iron without asking the questions? And that's the thing. It's like, why are these things elevated? Why is that happening? Instead of just giving more iron or giving more B12 if it's low, it's like, is that actually the process we need to take to fix this? And so I think there's not a lot of questions that get asked.
I think that was really my point. And I didn't want to get in a conversation about my dad, but I did want to use it as an example of where oftentimes doctors will look at blood and they'll say, oh, this is, yeah, like you just said, your iron's low or your iron's high or your B12 is low. And I'll be like, well, you need to take more B12. Well, is it really? Like, I had elevated things in my blood and you didn't say, oh, well, you need more of this or you need less of that. So here would be one question I would have is for listeners listening to this, how often should they be getting their blood taken? And then what are the mechanisms that they can use rather than just going to their GP and having a doctor read it and get an answer like, oh, your iron's too low. We need to give you some iron pills. What are their options for that? Because I legit don't know. Until we found you, that's exactly what we went through.
That's a hard question. I don't know either, really. I mean, it's something that I've spent 20 years learning and practicing and understanding. So I think the question is, you need to find somebody who understands how to look at it from a whole picture instead of just looking at one set of blood. So what's happening in the whole person here when their bloods are out? As far as how often, it depends on your age. It depends on what's going on for you. It depends if you have any symptoms. I think once a year is pretty good just to kind of keep a regular check on things and finding somebody who can read them a little bit differently. Because I think if in disease states, of course, the medical profession are going to be great at diagnosing disease states. But for most people, they're just looking to optimize their health. They want to feel good. And I think, unfortunately for a lot of people, they'll go to their GP and they'll say, I'm tired, I don't feel right, something's going on. And then their bloods come back and they look within range. And then they're told nothing's wrong and to go home. And I think that to optimize health is different than being in a disease state. And I think that's where GPs, our doctors they're looking for the disease state. And sometimes we don't have disease states, but we want to feel better. And we want to optimize our health.
You just about nailed 80% of the people I know, right? They're like, oh, you know, I'm tired. Whatever the story is, and they don't know where to go. And when they go to their GP is like, sleep more or, you know, eat better. Or
take an antidepressant.
Yeah. So I will say, can you walk the listener through what you do and what we did as your clients is, and then what helps you see what's actually going on with the body?
Most of the time, we'll do a battery of tests alongside the process that I work through. So I like to work with genetics because it gives me a blueprint. We will always do a genetic test. So we just get raw data. I use Ancestry or 23andMe, and I get a raw data file, and I extract that and interpret it. And so that gives me a good understanding of how you're set up. Where are your biggest challenges in your genetics? And it doesn't always mean that because there's a block or there's something going on or a slow enzyme that it's going to cause an effect. And so it's just going through and going, how do we metabolize our brain chemistry? What does our immune system look like? How fast do we detoxify caffeine and other drugs that come into the system? What are we doing with our hormones? Are our hormones slow to metabolize and detoxify? We're kind of getting a setup of how you look. And then when we do put it together with a symptom picture, so what's going on for you, what's been going on for you, what is your history? And then we look at hormones or an organic acid test and see what's happening in the gut. And so we're kind of getting a whole picture of how you're set up, but what's actually happening at the moment. So just looking at DNA for me is not enough without the symptoms, without something else backing it up. And that's why I get a little bit frustrated with some of the people who are out there giving, you know, they'll give you 10 genes, for example, and they'll say, here's your 10 genes, this is what's happening with them, take this supplement. And the body doesn't work like that because there's so much else that goes on. I look at about 300 genes and it's not the be-all and end-all. If you're not having a symptom or you're not having an issue with anything functionally, then just taking a supplement because you've got a specific gene variant, I think it's not a good way to treat a person. We had to look at hormones, we had to look at organic acids and see what's happening in the gut for you. There were some bacterial infections that we needed to clear up. And then also in that, we can see whether oxalates are an issue, because I don't like taking food away from people unless they need to. And I think that's the other problem at the moment. We keep taking more and more away from people. It's like, well, I don't feel good, so I'll cut out carbohydrates, or I'll cut out sugar, or I'll cut out whatever it is. And we keep taking food away instead of understanding why we're not tolerating it at the moment. And so looking at how our gut's functioning, how our neurotransmitters are functioning, so how are we feeling, you know, how our brain's working, and also whether we've got functional deficiencies in our B vitamins or vitamin C or glutathione. So it's kind of going, okay, this is how I'm set up. This is how I feel at the moment. And what data do we have to back that up? And so blood, they're a good backup. And they're good to, because we can do them regularly to check, you know, if we're making a difference in certain areas. But yeah, so it's getting a blueprint. It's understanding how that's actually expressing itself. Because like I said, just looking at one gene and taking a supplement for it, it doesn't necessarily work. And sometimes it can cause more problems than it fixes.
When we started working together, I would say that, you know, I had extreme joint pain, tons of inflammation, pretty much tired on a consistent basis. Not like feeling like I have to go to bed. Well, sometimes brain fog and lack of clarity and lack of being able to think. And I would have ranked all those problems at about if 10 is awesome, I would have said I was like a 6 or a 7. But now that I've been through it, well, one of the big things was the brain clarity was like, holy shit. Like, this is unbelievable. I mean, I felt like it was like one of those actors in the movie where they take the pill and it's like, I literally felt like that. I mean, that was massive for me. The inflammation is pretty much completely gone. The only time I feel, and actually I was like this morning, I had an unbelievably stressful day. We had about 4 hours of just absolute horseshit going on. And I could feel it in my body. Like, my nervous system was really vibrating. I don't know why I said that. I just wanted people to understand, like, sometimes I didn't know how bad I was. I didn't know how, you said it earlier, optimized versus feeling well. There's a massive difference between being optimized. You know, if I was to re-rank myself today, where I would have said I was a 6 or 7 out of 10, I probably was like a 3, 4, or 5. From my current perspective, I'm like a 9 or 10 in most of the areas. You know, maybe the odd day, if, you know, I do feel like if I'm off the diet or I have drinks or whatever, I'll slide back down to an 8, but it's temporary.
And I think that's the thing. I think we don't know how good we can feel until we feel like that. And then it gives us a different perspective on how bad we're actually feeling. I think that's, it's quite common. And also in quite driven and successful people, you'll find that they just kind of get up and do it anyway. You know, they've got a myriad of tasks and it doesn't matter how tired they are or how crap they're feeling. They'll just do it anyway because that's their makeup and they'll just be driven to get it done. But I think that's the thing. I think when you can optimize your brain space and how you feel and your energy levels and your concentration, it also kind of allows you to take that to the next level as well. And I've worked with, you know, some really successful people. And one thing that I have found is that even though they're successful, sometimes if they haven't looked after their health, even just, you know, working on that and, you know, changing the way that their brain functions and when it's clearer and they can make better decisions. And I think that it definitely helps in that regard as well. It helps you kind of be the best version of yourself, especially when you are busy and you are stressed, optimizing that the best you can. And it is a little bit harder because you do need time. And I think we do need to learn how to calm our nervous system, because I think we keep stimulating it a lot. When we're stressed, it's like, how do we get more energy? How do I get more energy? Rather than going, how do I actually calm my central nervous system? How do I clear things up so I can think clearly and I can have better energy and cleaner energy production? I think that there's, you know, steps that can be taken. It's a process.
Let's talk about some of those steps, because, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, I'm leaving in a few days to go to Morocco with my mastermind group for 5 days. My preparation for those meetings, one of my reflections on this year was probably one of the most significant things that I've done to optimize, I'll just call it my life, but even business, is investing in working with you. I'm not here to, I don't make anything off of this. I don't sell anything on this podcast. I just want people to have a shot at having a better, more improved, more elevated life in all areas, whether it's health, mindset, business, relationships, intimate, children, all that stuff. To me, it's so, so important. And that's what this podcast is really all about. And so that's why I really wanted to have you on the show, because it's meant so much to me this year. From an energy standpoint, let's talk about energy. That's a great spot to be, because at this time, like, we're probably 20 minutes into this podcast and people are driving going, hey, what are we going to talk about? Like, so, but, or they're sitting there driving and going, okay, yeah, I feel tired. Yes, my doctor says my iron is low, or I can't work out the way I want to work out because of my pain in my body. And it's like, it doesn't have to be this way. And there's enough people out there as well. Like, there's other famous people who, you know, and I can think of one off the top of my head, has these similar claims of having immense changes in their physiology and how it's led to the success of their life. And so let's talk about energy and start there. And let's kind of start to unravel some of this.
When it comes to energy, I think that we are, as a society, we're overstimulated, we're driven for success. And I think that we've lost the ability to relax in a lot of ways. And one of the biggest things is that we aren't in touch with the earth anymore. So most people knock at their feet on the ground. I've worked with a lot of people in cities, and especially in New York, and they're some of my most challenging, because it's very hard for them to stay connected to the environment. They're in apartments, and then they go out of their apartment, they're on a train, they're in an office, and they'll train. The biggest thing for me is that we've lost the connection to the environment. That really helps in a lot of ways, especially calm the nervous system. So when we're talking about energy, I think that when we're in that stress state all the time, the energy requirements that we have, a lot of the times we'll actually not digest and detoxify properly because we're in a sympathetic nervous system state all the time. We have to digest our food, we have to assimilate our food, and we have to detoxify properly in order to have a clean energy system. And also, like I said, part of that is having good relationships, it's having good sleep, it's having good quality food. At the moment, we're so busy and stressed, and a lot of us aren't taking the time to foster our relationships, to sleep well, and to eat well. And I think because we get a little bit off track with our energy and our brain fog, and we start looking for that one thing. So, and that's where a lot of those little Instagram reels come in. It's like, just do this and everything will be better. You know, just, you know, cold plunge every day and your life will be great. Or, you know, just fast and, you know, and all these magical things will happen. And the truth is, it really depends on the person. And everybody, even from a dietary perspective, we'll need different things to make energy correctly. And it depending on where you are in your life and what else is going on. For me personally, I do really well with a very high carbohydrate diet. In the social media sphere, that's frowned upon at the moment, but that's how I run the best, you know. And other people will sit on the sliding scale somewhere else. And I think we just keep taking things away, expecting that we're going to get more energy from reducing the amount of food we have or reducing macronutrients in food. And I think that's not the case. I think we need to get all the basics down first. So are you sleeping well? Are you exercising? You know, but are you also getting movement? If training is different than movement. We might be training more as in the gym, but are we walking? Are we outside? Are we, so there's more involved.
Can you give us some criteria? And I know part of, you know, really what you do is, at least what I've learned from you, is one size doesn't fit all. But if there was some parameters, and because I think there's people here that you had just talked about energy, and you talked about, you know, we're driven more nowadays, we're not in touch with the earth as much, we're, you know, not sleeping as much, or we're struggling in relationships, food, you know, there's a number of different other things too that you mentioned. How do we start to unpack this, and how do people start to, like, let's take food for example. So you spoke about food, and you know, like, the big trend now is fasting. I don't do it. I don't know the science behind it, but I do know that, you know, people go, you want to lose weight, fast. Well, okay, that makes sense because you're going to take in less calories. So no brainer. But what is it costing you, you know, in your energy system to fast? I don't have the answer to it, and I don't know enough about it, so I don't do it. But I've been pretty successful over the years at eating 5 or 6 times a day on a consistent basis. And, you know, at 53, I'm pretty strong and I'm in pretty good shape and I'm going to stick with it. But maybe it's awesome for some people. And maybe some people thrive on it. So I don't want to say it's not good. But how would people know, like, if they were to go out and try to fast? So somebody's right now listening to us talk and they're like, okay, but well, what do I do? Or what would be the parameters or the bumpers that you would put on a trial process, for example, for fasting or for any other diet, to say, hey, try it for X amount of time, keep these things static and change one thing at a time and see what you're trying, like a science experiment almost. I want to try to give the listeners something that they can at least sink their teeth into to whether or not something's working for them or not.
Things need a time basis. And I think that I would also encourage people to, like I said, get the basics down first. So if you can eat three meals a day and you can prepare them from scratch, you know, at home, and you're getting some movement, what is that looking like? And what's your goals? I mean, you know, is your goal weight loss? Is it health? Is it, because they're going to be completely different outcomes. Is it brain clarity that you're looking for? And most people now, it's kind of weight loss, like it's staying lean. And you're right, as far as fasting is concerned, most of the literature is around when you equate it to another diet with the same amount of calories, with proteins equated for, it doesn't really make much difference to weight loss. Some people like it and they feel good, but in the end, it's mainly just a way to control calories. People should try things if they want to. But I think, yeah, so start, if you were going to fast, you'd want to do it for, find something that works for your schedule, because there's all different ways to fast. Like I said, I'm not a huge fan, especially for women.
Why is that?
We have major hormonal fluctuations, and it seems to be that it's puts more stress on the system for women than it does for men. Men seem to be a little bit more stable in their hormones. Like there's a lot of people fasting now, a lot of people. But it's, I guess, how do you feel? Are you reaching your goals with it? And understanding what it's doing, if it's just a reduction in calories, is there another way that you can do that without having that restriction? So is there another way of reducing calories over the day where you don't have to go for such a prolonged period without eating? And then what is that actually doing? Is it putting, you know, it does put stress on the body. And so I think that's the thing at the moment, is trying to find things that actually are more calming rather than more stressful for us, because I think we're kind of flogging a dead horse a lot of the time. You know, people are tired and they're, you know, but they're doing things that are actually stressful for the system. And yes, if you reduce your calories enough, you will lose weight. But it's, how do we get the body to increase its metabolic rate so that we can actually eat more and get enough nutrients in to fuel our body? And I think that's the problem. We've kind of slowed the rate at which we're using energy. We've slowed it because we're stressed, we're tired. And most of us, like I said, even if you train in the gym, we're really not getting a lot of movement. And so you'd have to bring your calories down for a lot of people too low to get the nutrients you need in order to lose weight when you've got such a slow system. And so for me, it's what can you do to actually increase your metabolic rate? What can we do to increase the rate at which we're going to use the energy that we're putting in?
What I kind of heard there was, from a basic weight loss scenario, there's two things. There's one, your basic metabolic rate. And if you're not eating on a consistent basis, your metabolic rate is slowing. The slower your metabolic rate runs, the fewer calories you have to take in order to lose weight. So the more you feed the body with proper food and timing and all that kind of stuff, but you can increase your body's metabolic rate and therefore then diet on more calories.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. It's what things are pro-metabolic, like what things are actually going to help you with your increased energy output. And I think the thing too, when you feel better, if you can get we're kind of in a race all the time. It's like, I just need to lose weight now. But sometimes it's a process, and it's, if I can get my brain clearer, I can feel better. If I can get more energy, then I'm going to feel like moving more as well. And so it's kind of a process of building, especially because a lot of people have been dieting on and off for years, especially women. And they get to the point where they really can't eat a lot and they're still kind of staying at that maintenance weight. And it's like, how do we build you to the top of your maintenance calories where you're not actually putting on weight? But how do we get you there and keep you there for a while and so that you actually feel better? Because when you feel better and your brain's clearer, you're more motivated, you want to go and do more. And then when you can kind of do that, then you can start pulling the calories down when you need to. And I think of it like kids, you know, who have never dieted and they've eaten and they sometimes get through their teenage years and into their early 20s and will put on weight. And all they'd have to make very few changes and the weight will just fall off. You know, what we did in our 20s was very different because we were starting from a different point. The more stressed we are too, the more we conserve energy, the way we utilize glucose changes. And so this is why we think we've got, you know, a glucose problem. And as you know, I'm not anti sugar or any carbohydrates. Again, it's mechanisms. It's like, what is happening in the body that you're not tolerating that? What's happening so that sugar is not getting into the cell, you know? And so it's more looking at the system as a whole and the metabolic system as a whole. It's not just one food is causing a problem. It's got to be looked at as the whole person. And like I said, especially in women who've been dieting for so long, you know, sometimes there's got to be a period where you rebuild how you feel, you rebuild the way your brain functions, you rebuild how your liver is detoxifying and how your gut's functioning. And when you start to do that and you feel better and you're starting to run at a higher rate, then you can drop calories and it'll make a difference. But a lot of people struggle to get through that process first. But if you're somebody who has been doing that for a long time, you know, sometimes you've got to reverse it out first. Otherwise, sometimes you can be eating low calories and you can lose weight, but you're going to start having health problems because you're not getting the nutrients required in that many calories.
And sometimes I feel like there's just misguided goals too at the beginning of this, where people will go, hey, I need to lose weight in 2 months because it's going to be, well, in Canada, it's May 24, or, you know, it's July, or I got a wedding I'm going to go to in 2 months and I got to get some weight off to fit into this dress or whatever. And it's like, it's not necessarily lifestyle. Like, I just started doing some different training a couple of years ago, and I gave myself a 1 year goal. Like, I started doing this specific thing. I'm not going to get into it because it's not relevant, but the point of it was I set a goal for 1 year. Like, not, oh, I want to be doing something in a month, or, you know, I was like, I'm going to do, the first goal was 1 year. And then after the year, you started redefining the goal for the next 3 months or 6 months. Like, it started to get a little bit tighter and more refined. But the first one was just like really generic. And I think, you know, especially for people who are trying, they're just misguided goals. So I think that would be my comment to the listener is, you know, what is your goal? What's your outcome? And I think you kind of said that earlier too. It's like, what is your outcome? And what is the realistic time frame? And if you're saying like 1 month, you might have to probably look at that.
Yeah, especially with the history of dieting, the dieting culture, and being, you know, in a stress state. And a perfect example of that is in the Minnesota starvation experiment. So they, in the 40s, they took a group of men, and they call it a starvation experiment, but they were only on, I think they were on 1,500 or 1,600 calories, which is pretty normal for people now. They're kind of aiming for that. But these men, they obviously lost weight, but they went from like 3,000 calories a day down to, you know, 1,600. And what they found, even though they were losing weight, was that a lot of the symptoms that they were experiencing in their mind and their physical body, how they were feeling, and the inflammation and mentally how they were going, is very similar to a lot of the symptoms we have today in an overfed population. So we obviously have quite a lot of people who are overweight in society, but the symptoms that they're experiencing were very similar to the Minnesota starvation experiment. And it's because they were devoid of nutrients. And we kind of, even though we're overfed calories, sometimes we actually devoid of nutrients. So you can have an excess amount of weight, whether it's fluid or whether it's adipose, like fat, but you can still be deficient in certain nutrients because we're undernourished. We're, you know, sometimes overfed, but undernourished. And it was very interesting to kind of see the symptom picture match up, because they were supposed to be starving and we're getting the same symptoms in people who are overweight because we're undernourished, I think. And so that's a big problem.
You mentioned earlier, so one thing I wanted to close the loop on was fasting. Just wanted to make the distinction, this is like question of intermittent fasting, which is the new thing nowadays, versus the effects of fasting for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 days, 7 days. That's not something I have any real experience in personally. So I kind of always said, oh, I want to do a 3-day fast, and I never get around to be honest. So
yeah, I think it's, for me, it's never black and white. And I always would try and support my patients to do what they felt. And if they felt they wanted to try that, then that's up to them. I think it's a massive stress on the body, and I think you want to know why you're doing it and what the possible outcome could be. Because for most people, the 3-day fast, they'll end up feeling good, but you have to raise stress hormones in that state. And the reason we do is that we have this need for blood glucose, especially in the brain. And when we don't have enough in the blood, which you will inevitably not after you start fasting, the body has to increase its stress hormones to make new glucose. It's called gluconeogenesis. So we're making the production of new glucose from, you know, in the body, to keep our levels stable. Sometimes when you first get those stress hormones, it's anti-inflammatory. So they first pass, they're anti-inflammatory. So you can feel quite good. Fasting, people kind of get this little high, but it's from the stress hormones. And so it's just, what is your purpose of doing that for 3 days? If you're going to go back to eating normally, do we see any major changes in 3 days? And there's some research on autophagy, and that I think from the literature I've seen, it doesn't make much difference whether you have a caloric deficit or whether you fast. I think over the time, the literature seems to be the same as far as autophagy in that is concerned. So autophagy is just kind of cleaning up old cells, you know, which we need to do. It's kind of cleaning out the old debris, but it happens whether you're in a calorie deficit or whether you're fasting. And so I think it's just, what are the benefits versus the risk for you with fasting?
I mean, a lot of people are saying there's massive benefits from, you know, a 3-day or a 4-day fast or a 7-day fast. But so what you're basically saying is like the autophagy part of it, which is the cleansing of the cells, is useful. But also, can you get the same by reducing calories? Can you get the same autophagy as fasting?
Yeah. Look, we turn over cells all the time. And yes, as far as I know, the literature that I've seen, you can kind of find, you can almost find a study to tell you anything that you think you already know. And that's why I guess my advice is never black and white, which I know is a little bit challenging, but I think it just depends on the person. It depends on what part of your life you're in. I think somebody who is chronically stressed, I wouldn't suggest fasting for them. If you're a male and you're in a good, healthy state and you're eating well and you want to try it, I don't see any problem with it. I just don't know if it's the be-all and end-all that it's made out to be. I don't think it's a miracle for anything. I just think that, yes, if you eat really well and you've got all your ducks in a row and you eat in your maintenance or a calorie deficit, depending on what your goals are, I don't think there's any benefit to fasting. Sometimes, I mean, for some people, there's some stuff around cancer and stuff in long fasts, but I don't know enough about the literature. That's more anecdotal for people. And anecdotal's great, I think, for, you know, when you're trying to work out your own journey. And I think that's the thing. It's how do I feel doing that? What does that look like for me? But as far as across the board, I don't think there's a lot of literature that I've seen that gives it any kind of special power. We like to say that, but I don't think there is.
I think sometimes too, people like to say, you know, I did a 3-day fast, and it's kind of a bit of a badge of honor. There's this new thing out that people are doing. So what is it? Hard 76 or hard 72 or something?
75 hard.
Work out twice a day for 70 days and don't drink and whatever, eat good. It's like, oh, okay. Like,
it works for people because, you know, it gives them something structured to follow. And if you're training twice a day and you're, you know, taking out alcohol and I think that one also has a shift in diet. And I mean, yeah, you will have a change, but I think for me, it's getting people to try and look long-term at kind of what they're going to be able to do that's sustainable for them, but that makes them feel good. And I think that's the thing. I think we sometimes have unrealistic goals of how we should look and where that should sit. So most people might, you know, health-wise, be in their best position, you know, 5 or 6 kilos heavier than what they look their best in. And so it's also a lot of getting our head around how we want to look versus where we feel our best. And I think, yeah, that's a bit of an issue too.
Yeah, like how do you want to perform versus how do you look?
Yeah. And also what, you know, your age and what you, you know, want to do with your life. And for me personally, you know, at this age, you know, I'm 40, 44, I love food and I think we've lost the joy of food. And I think we've lost the joy of, you know, sharing meals and, you know, because everyone is so restricted now with everything. And, you know, for me, I've got myself to the place where I can pretty much eat anything, you know, and I want to enjoy food and I want to have a glass of wine on the weekend if I want to. And, you know, I want a lot more balance in my life now. And so I think it depends where you are in your life and what's important to you as well.
You and your husband are in great shape.
Yeah.
Your husband's a stud.
He is.
He's legit. Like, I mean, I've met him online and the guy is, he's really doing well.
And all those things are really important, but it's, if you can get yourself to the point where you're digesting food well, and you feel good and your relationships are good and you're happy, it makes all the other stuff easier. When you're stressed, and because our digestive system is so linked to our nervous system, like I said, when you're in a chronic state of stress, we've got our sympathetic nervous system and our parasympathetic nervous system. And the parasympathetic nervous system is our rest and digest, right? That's the organ, so our liver and our digestive system. But when you're always in a state of stress, the body will not rest and digest properly. And so we have an issue then with food digestion and assimilation. And then we have, you know, like I said, this lack of nutrients in the body. And like I said, and we keep trying to take things away. And I think that we're doing ourselves a disservice by taking things away.
Let's lead into that because we talked about fasting and we talked about the stress on the body in fasting. And if you'd said like, listen, if you're optimal shape and your optimal, you know, probably mindset too, and all that kind of stuff. And you want to try fast? Great, try fast. But if you're struggling, your body's in stress, maybe fasting is not the optimal thing to do at this time. There's a couple questions in here. One is fasting for women, because you'd kind of made that distinction earlier. Then you also had talked about like glucose. To me, that rolls very closely into, you know, nutrients versus calories. So I'm wondering if we can move into it that way.
The other big thing at the moment is glucose monitors and trying to work out, you know, insulin spikes, and it's everywhere at the moment. And I think that, again, we're looking for the 1%, and our body should, we should release glucose after we eat. Our blood sugar should rise, and then our insulin should come out. And, you know, it's normal to have peaks and troughs. And I think trying to control our diets so that we never get an insulin spike or a glucose spike, I think is a disservice to us as well, because it has its place. And like I said, I'm a big fan of glucose and carbohydrates, especially when we're stressed. So one of the only things that will balance adrenaline is glucose. And that's why people will look for, they say, I'm, you know, addicted to carbs, or I'm craving sugar. And it's often because the body is not making energy correctly, because we're in a stress state. So we're using fatty acids instead. But the body will, because we don't have enough glucose getting in to make energy, it's kind of stuck in the blood. The body will look for more to balance the stress response. So we might blame glucose and carbohydrates, and then we try and take them out instead of going, okay, what's happening in the system and why are we not utilizing them properly? We're craving them, but we're not utilizing them properly, because we have sensors in the body that detect these things.
So you said earlier, glucose balances adrenaline.
So that's why, for example, if you have a black coffee, it will push the adrenaline, will actually cause the glucose to come out of the blood and into the cell. And that's why some people get a bit racy. And that's why I don't like black coffee usually without some kind of sugar, because you can sometimes get an adrenaline, like a dump of glucose into the cells. And if you didn't have any glucose with the coffee, you'll get that kind of low and the jittery adrenaline response from the coffee.
Because the caffeine pushes the glucose.
Yeah, so we get an adrenaline response from caffeine. Oftentimes we'll get an adrenaline response. And that's why people say don't have coffee. You know, it affects the nervous system. But it's not that. It's that, yes, you will get an adrenaline response. If you have it with a meal or you have glucose in the blood, you won't get the low, because you'll have some glucose to actually put into the cell. So caffeine's actually pro-metabolic. It actually helps with energy production. But if you don't have any glucose in the blood, sometimes you can get the hypo, so the low glucose feeling, and you get a bit jittery from it. People will say, have a black coffee, and they feel terrible, and they're like, oh, coffee's bad. It's bad for my nervous system. It probably wasn't that. If you had it with a meal, or you had a couple of teaspoons of real sugar or honey or whatever you wanted in it, most people won't get that adrenaline response from it.
So how does that get handled? Like, many of the people that I talk to when they intermittent fast, they won't eat till like, whatever, noon. Or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'll have a coffee or two coffees in the morning, and it's typically black, because what's the point of fasting if you're going to have sugar and cream in it? Or having a mocha latte from wherever, Starbucks. So if you drink coffee while you're trying to fast, how does that work?
Same thing. Not everybody will feel it or get a massive adrenaline response. And believe it or not, like I said, you don't have to always have glucose to, like, eating it to have glucose in the blood. So oftentimes when people fast, when people are checking their ketones and things, because a lot of the time that's why they're fasting, to put themselves into ketosis, their blood can still be elevated with sugar, because we do have the ability, like I said, to make it when it's not there. And I think that's the thing that frustrates me a little bit. People say, well, you don't need to have carbohydrates because the body can make them. But my question to that is, they're obviously so important that when we don't eat them, the body is going to make them, because we need this steady supply of glucose to the brain and to the body. And so we have a backup mechanism. So if it's not there, we will make it. And so I think, like I said to you before, I think we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to sugar and when it comes to carbohydrates.
Can we differentiate or identify what sugar is? Like, when you're talking about glucose is not a bad thing necessarily, but probably too much is not a good thing. A bottle of Coca-Cola with a candy bar and a, you know, and a this and a that. Like, where do we draw the line, and where do we identify what is positive, influential glucose, or where it gets negative?
Yeah, and I think it depends on the person and where they are. So if you have any insulin resistance, obviously there's other things that you're going to need to do, and just throwing a lot more glucose at it it's not going to fix it. So you need to work out why there's insulin resistance. And oftentimes there's inflammation and there's other things going on that need addressing. And so you'd start, I don't ever take it out. But you would maybe start with a lower level of glucose or a lower level of carbohydrates and then build it up as you become less insulin resistant. And so we've got carbohydrates. And then when I say sugar, it's usually glucose and some other molecules. So we've got sucrose is my favorite, I think, which is like fruit, honey, maple syrup, raw sugar, because you're getting a balance of glucose and fructose together. And most of the time they'll come with other nutrients that help them, like potassium. You know, if you're having fruit, the potassium helps regulate the blood sugar as well. So it's a difference between doing that and then doing the starches. So starches are like potato, bread, the other forms of carbohydrates. And so they're just long chains of glucose molecules together that make up a starch. But sucrose, which is, like I said, the fruit, honey, maple syrup, that's a combination of glucose and fructose. And so it's understanding what you do better with. So if you've got, you know, if you have gut issues, sometimes reducing the starch can help, because the starch can sometimes feed bacteria in the gut. And so that's why it's, you can play with different things. But I think that people are too scared to play with some of these things on their own, because we've been told sugar is bad. It's like, or carbohydrates are bad. And so they don't know where to start with how to introduce it. And because we're so scared of it all the time. And I'll have people come to me and they're like, I'm dairy free, I'm sugar free, I'm gluten free. You know, I was like, what's left? Yeah, what are you eating? And so it is a bit scary because we've been told how bad some of these things are. But I think that if you've got a really balanced diet and you're starting from scratch, like you're preparing most of your meals, I think that that's a really good place to start, and not take some of these things out. Just go, okay, how much energy am I actually outputting? What can I do to increase the amount of energy I'm outputting so that I can eat more food and get the nutrients I need? It definitely comes back to that stress state. Like I said to you, that's the big thing for me. We're always stressing the system in some way.
One of the things that just popped in my head there as you're saying that, it's like, at what point does, you know, somebody go, well, I'm stressed, so it's okay for me to eat, you know, ice cream or some type of glucose or whatever.
That's the really tricky bit, because it's like, yes, you need that, but also we still have to think about our caloric balance. And it might be that if you're really stressed and you need to kind of add some of those things in, then you might want to pull the fats down. And so that's the thing. If we keep protein stable, it doesn't really matter from a caloric standpoint, really, if you up the fats or the carbohydrates. I think it just depends on what you do well with. And if people are stressed or they've got major gut issues, I like to increase the carbohydrates a little and pull the fats down, just because it does help protect the nervous system. It does help calm the nervous system. And like I said, our body, it tells us, you know, like I said, when people are stressed, they're going to be looking for carbohydrates. And there's a reason for that. And we fight it. We just go, well, we can't have it. And then most people will give in and binge and they'll eat something that really wasn't that good for them. And I think too, when we're talking about sugar and people say, well, I'm addicted to sugar. And I'm like, what are we talking about when we talk about sugar? And if you were addicted to sugar, people would be eating white sugar out of a bowl. And it's like most of the time they're not talking about fruit, honey and maple syrup. And they're talking about eating, you know, pastries and biscuits. And that's different because it's got starches, it's got fats, it's, you know, it's a complete, and it does have some sugar, but that wouldn't be what I would consider a sugar meal. So it's the combinations. But if we kind of strip all that back and people go, okay, I'm going to make my meals and I'm going to have some eggs and bacon in the morning. I'm going to have a little bit of orange juice with it. And then I'm going to have my salad for lunch and, you know, a couple of squares of dark chocolate. And I think the problem is when people pull it out completely and they're craving it, and then they kind of get to the point where they just consume a lot in a form that they probably didn't need to have it in. You know, so they will look for the pastries and they'll look for chocolate and things like that. And when you get it balanced and if you don't take it out and you actually give it as it's needed in forms that the body can utilize, you don't seem to crave it as much. And that's usually what I find.
It's crazy how complex the human body is. Like as you're saying these things, and I often just try to put myself in the listener's position, because many times I am the listener. Like I am like sitting here going, okay, I'm trying to suck in as much as I can potentially get here. And so probably honestly, because we don't sell advertising on this podcast, like this is costing me the most. So I really want to get the information, but I'm a grower. I love growing. I love learning. And as you were talking about this, I'm like, where could the listener go? So one of the things that popped into my head was there's a book a long time ago that I read, which was Eating for Your Blood Type. I think it was the name of it. And I'm not suggesting people, like I'm not giving advice, but I'm asking you, like, where could people go if they're listening to this going, okay, well, what should I be eating? Or what would be the indicators where it's like, well, you could try this. And then if this is not sitting well with your stomach or your gut or your bowels or whatever it is, maybe flip a little bit to that. Like, is there some type of guidance or?
It is. Yeah. I know that's quite hard and quite confusing because most of the time my answer is going to be, it depends on the person. Yeah, it's hard. I know. And I'd love to just go, look, this is the best way to eat and everybody should do this. And it's just not the truth. But I think that people will often know how they feel with certain foods. And I think definitely getting your protein stable first. So setting yourself a caloric goal, and there's lots of different calculators. It depends, you know, where you are and if you want to lose weight or put on weight. And then get your protein stable and try and do the basics right first. So get your protein stable, get a caloric goal, and try and meet that and try and work out what, you know, are you getting, you know, enough nutrients in? And even though, you know, that's hard for people, there's ways you can check that. So you can use Chronometer, which is an app that you can kind of put your food into, and you can see what nutrients you are getting and what you aren't. But just for basic, because people are sometimes too busy and they don't, you know, that's too much for them. But I think setting yourself a structure where you've got a caloric level that you want to meet, getting your protein stable over the day, and then filling it with either carbs or fats, depending on what you like to eat and how you feel. And like I said, I would say if you're stressed, if you've got a lot of stress, I'd probably lower the fats and increase carbohydrates. And like I said, you can track this for a little while. You don't need to track food forever, but it's a really good way sometimes, especially women with protein. I found until sometimes they kind of track it, they don't realize how much they're under eating protein, and it can make a huge difference to our hormones, to our brain function, to our muscle development, to our immune system. And so I think that that's really important. It's just starting to understand what your diet looks like now and trying to make most of your meals at home if you can. And like I said, I wouldn't be cutting a major food group out, but I'd have a plan and try and stick to that for a period of time and go, during that time, you know, for that month, did I put on weight? Did I lose weight? And then adjust from there. Do I feel better? Am I getting bloated in my belly? If I'm getting bloated, you know, maybe I need to look at pulling some of the starches down, because they will, you know, can sometimes cause some bloating. And then also, okay, so do I need to go and get some testing done? Like, do I need to check, you know, some things that are, you know, that I'm feeling might be happening? It's good to sometimes get someone to support you with it. It's hard sometimes to know, but I think if you get the basics down, it's like, where in my life can I get more exercise, or can I get on the earth, or can I, you know, it's kind of having the building those habits that we can do every day that I think make the biggest difference. And then the food can be kind of manipulated from there. But I think we're trying to fix everything with food. We just think that if there's anything going on, if I just take this food away, it's going to fix it. There's other things that are impacting it that are more important.
Food's an interesting conversation in general, because it's gotten so expensive. And people are immediately, like at the very beginning of this, we kind of talked about food. And one of the things that popped in my head was the quality of food and, you know, whether we should eat organic or whether or not, you know, we shouldn't eat organic. And I'm curious if you have an opinion on organic meats and fishes and all that kind of stuff, because people are making decisions based on their pocketbook to alter, you know, potentially the food or the quality of food that they're eating.
Yeah. It is. It's getting really tough. And it also depends where in the world you live and what you have access to. You know, when we were in Mexico, there's very little dairy there. Where here, we've got really good dairy and I eat quite a lot of it. And so it depends what you've got access to. But yes, I think that for me, it doesn't have to be necessarily organic. I think there's some crops that are really heavily sprayed if you could avoid them. I think if you can get, you know, some of the berries and stuff are pretty heavily sprayed. And there's the EWG put like a dirty dozen up, so the 12 most heavily sprayed crops. And I think if you can avoid that, or even use local farmers markets and things where, you know, you can talk to the farmers. With meat, I think it's not so much the organic certification. I think if they've been on grass, I think that's really important. So for cattle, for example, I think if you can, where they've lived their most normal life without hormones and antibiotics, and I think that makes a big difference. It also makes a difference to the quality, but also the type of fat in, for example, a cow will be different whether it's been fed on grain or whether it's been fed on the grass. So it can change the composition of the meat that you're eating. And so, yeah, I think if you can, proteins, if you can get your protein, good quality proteins, I know they're really expensive, but that's probably where I would spend my money with food. I think that that's really important, especially if you're doing quite a lot of protein, finding some good quality proteins. Eggs can be I know they're more expensive now, but they're a really good kind of complete food. And most people have access to kind of some decent eggs that from chickens that haven't been cooped up now. Like we can get some free-ranged eggs. Most people have access to it. And that's probably a really good way of adding them in. I don't think you necessarily need expensive, you know, protein powders and stuff unless you are training and you want to add them in. Most people can get there with food. So yes, I mean, personally, I have a lot of organic stuff because I have good access to it. But I know that's not the case for everybody. Using your money towards proteins rather than necessarily everything organic, I think is probably where I would use my money. The quality of the proteins, yeah.
Cool. Is there something, so we're like literally an hour or more into this and we have like talked about food and there's like probably 100 other things that I wanted to talk about. So we're going to go to a second episode for sure. Like this is going to get divided into two. Is there anything when it comes to food that you wanted to cover off that really, you know, is important for people to consider because it's such a vital part of who we become physiologically?
Yeah, I agree.
So if there's something that we've missed, I'd love to hear it.
I don't think there's good or bad food. Let's just say that. And I think that that's the problem now too. I think we're labeling things as good or bad. And I think that there's so many other things impacting the way that we're dealing with food. Yes, the food we get now, a lot of it is heavily processed and it's pretty crappy. If you're eating most of your food out, it's probably pretty crappy. And I think people can make a massive difference just cooking at home from scratch, making things themselves will make a massive difference to people's health, whether you've got high carbohydrate or high fat or whatever. It doesn't matter what the composition is. I think if you're making it from scratch, you're avoiding a lot of the issues. You're getting more nutrients in your food. So that's a big thing, but I don't think there's good or bad. If we're doing the, you know, 80% of our food at home and we're eating well and we're feeling good, I don't think there's a food that's going to be completely detrimental just to have once. We're kind of labeling things as good or bad. And I think people just don't know what to eat anymore because you've only got to hear, you know, like I said, you're hearing everything now. You're hearing, you know, sugar's bad, or even if you're going to have vinegar before you eat it so you don't spike your blood sugar, and you need a continuous blood sugar monitor. And, you know, we're kind of micromanaging something that just taking more away is not going to fix it. We need to fix our other things. We need to fix our light environment. So, you know, are you getting, you know, unfiltered sunlight every day? You know, that's a huge thing. That helps us build dopamine. It helps us, you know, build our melatonin so we can sleep at night. You know, are you getting your feet on the earth, which discharges energy, you know? And, you know, there's a lot of good research around depression and blood pressure and, you know, people walking on the beach instead of, you know, and rivaling, you know, some of the medications that they're giving. So there's, you know, are you doing those things? You know, are you sleeping, you know, 7 to 8 hours a night? Are you having time without devices, you know, and stimulant, you know, blue light stimulation, you know, are you getting some balance there? And I think that all those things make a huge difference.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate you being with us. If you found value in the show and know a friend or a coworker who could benefit from the conversation, please share the link via text or on social media. Remember, each share creates a ripple effect of knowledge and inspiration. We'll see you next week.
The views, information, or opinions expressed by guests during the Business of Doing Business podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Duane Kerrigan and his affiliates. Duane Kerrigan, or the Business of Doing Business podcast, is not responsible for and does not verify the accuracy of any of the information contained in the podcast series. The primary purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. Listeners are advised to consult with a qualified professional or specialist before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast.